Excellent. So welcome to today's talk. And because we were last night talking about all sorts of things, one thing which you asked for, and I thought, well, why not, let's talk about it today, is about enlightenment. I know that sometimes people say, oh, that's way beyond you, therefore you shouldn't even talk about it. But there's something about Buddhism. Everything is open. And the Buddha said he never taught with a closed fist. In other words, everything which was important he talked about. And even when he was in the forest, he picked up this bunch of leaves from the forest in his hand. Which are more, the leaves in my hand or the leaves in the forest? And the monks said, oh, the leaves in the forest. Much more than the leaves in your hand. He said, yes, what I've taught you compared to what I haven't taught you is like the leaves in my hand compared to the leaves in the forest. And people say, wow, that's proof there are secret teachings in the Dhamma. The leaves in the forest are much bigger than the leaves in his hand. But, he said, there's always the buts. The leaves in my hand are much less than the leaves in the forest. The Dhamma I've taught you is much less than all the things I know. But the reason I haven't told you all those other things is because they have nothing to do with enlightenment, with penetrating through. And what I've told you is what is necessary, what is helpful in order to attain the enlightenment experiences. That's all I've told you, and that's why I've told you it. And I like that story because it means that what the Buddha actually said is more than sufficient. It's actually everything he possibly could say to help people, you know, break through and become enlightened. So that's the first thing to say. There's no secret teachings. There's no teachings which have been hidden in Ajahn Brahm's cave. You've been in my cave, there's nothing in there at all. At least if there is, I haven't found it yet. Not in my cave. It's just my mattress and other stuff. So the idea of hidden teachings and an elite group of people, sometimes that can be quite disturbing, but it's also wrong. And sometimes that people say, oh, if you want to get enlightened, go the fast path. That's very sort of like Western, isn't it? Just we want the shortcuts, the fast path. Update your computer apps and you don't waste so much time. I don't know too much about computers, but when I do try and update something, it always takes much more time than it did before. I don't know why. Maybe because I'm just old. But anyway, always trying to take shortcuts is usually the longest way. And for those Sri Lankans here, I still remember just giving talks over in Sri Lanka, especially in Kandy. And the person who arranged that talk for me and took me from Colombo up to Kandy, he drove me back again. But being a Sri Lankan, he knew the shortcuts. And we got to the to Colombo where he lived so late. They were thought I'd been kidnapped or something. And so even he got totally lost. So it shows you that just the ordinary ways are usually the fastest. And always remember just the Buddha's great compassion. If there was a shorter way, he would have let you know it. And sometimes people claim to have a shorter way, but there's only the one way to enlightenment. That's, I think, verse 372 in the Dhammapada, where it says that Ezo wa mago nati anyo dasanasa visuddhiya. This is the only way. There is no other for the purity of insight. Eightfold Path. Not a one-fold path, not a two-fold path, not a sixfold path, the whole eightfold path. And there's a reason for that. And the reason for that is, of course, whatever you do, and it starts with wrong view. If you had right view, then you'd be at least a stream winner. But because we start with wrong view, you just have to be honest with yourself. Sometimes we think, this is right, this is right, this is how it should be done. This is how I can get nice meditation. And these days, a good example of that is, you know, even what I talk about a lot, the jhanas. And to go over to the United States and talk with a few of the leading Vipassana teachers there, and they were actually saying, well, our teachers in Burma have told us that, you know, the Vipassana is not enough. So now we're getting into jhanas, and they wanted my advice on that. But then what they were saying was, you know, being any US citizens here? I hope not. It's not that I don't like US citizens, but it was, they were saying that in the United States, they've made a new type of jhana. They call jhana light, L-I-T-E. You know, like you get sort of milk light and not so much cream. This light and that light. And it was actually quite funny. No, why not sort of just follow what the Buddha said? And just, you know, there's only four jhanas. Actually, there's five. There's one between the first and the second, but that's just a technicality. I usually put that in the second jhana category. But anyway, those jhanas are the way to enlightenment. There's many quotes. Without those jhanas, you cannot see things as they truly are. A good example of that is, if anyone wants to ever check me, because sometimes they think, oh, Ajahn Brahm says this, somebody else says something else, which is the right one? So you always have your references. And this is in the Mahamoggallana, Mahamalunkyaputta Sutta. It's number 64 of the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length sayings. It's a good one to read. Because in that sutta, it was actually saying, there's no way to even become a non-returner, an anagami, without first attaining the jhanas, let alone an arahat. So no more than you can cut through to the pith of a tree without going first through the bark and the sapwood. And it's a very obvious, simple simile. How can you get to the pith, the heartwood of a tree, without going through the bark and the sapwood? And that was one of the reasons why I think the nuns would know this, that Ajahn Wayama, when she founded Dhammasara Monastery, she called it Dhammasara, which is the heartwood of the tree. The only way you can get to the heartwood of a tree is actually go through the pith. So go through the bark and the sapwood, and then you get to the pith. And you need to actually get to the jhanas in order to see the truth. She was wise enough to know that. She was actually trained initially by Ajahn Ayakema. And she was very much into the jhanas. And anyway, when you understand that, you understand that, you know, you have to do those jhanas. And where do those jhanas come from? They come from an extreme amount of letting go. You do the Satipatthana, you can actually see all those four things we're supposed to focus on. You know, the body and other stuff in this universe. You can see the Vedana. I usually call that experience rather than the type of experience, you know, the happy, sad, or in between. But the experience, what is experience? It's totally out of control. You can't have a stable experience without it disappearing. It has to change. And you know, the third of the Satipatthana is understanding the jitta. I love that one because Now, many people say they do the third Satipatthana, but can you really do that Satipatthana, the third one, without experience of jhana? You don't even know what the citta is. You think you are, you do. What this mind is sixth sense. The way the Buddha described it, it's like if you're a goldsmith and you want to just make some ornaments, you've got to purify the gold first of all. As I would say that if you're a chemist and you want to know the properties of gold, you have to purify it from all the other trace elements, impurities, to get 100% gold. And then, of course, you can experiment with it and know what it is and how it works. It's the same way. And then that's the Buddha simile. And the only way you can know what the mind is actually to purify it from the other five senses. So you've just got the mind. Nothing but the mind. And that's the job of the jhanas. And the other ones, which come the fourth, they're called phenomenal or dhamma or whatever. But you know, you have one of those things like, you know, anicca, impermanence. In the Anapanasati, the mindfulness of the breath, once you've experienced that 12th stage of Anapanasati, the jhanas, the liberations of the mind, then afterwards you're supposed to focus, or the next stage or step or whatever, is actually focusing on anicca. What is anicca? That's one of the reasons why many people feel they understand what anicca is, and it's one of those they don't put much focus on. What actually is the impermanence? Is it impermanence? What is it? And again, one of the things which made me understand anicca much more deeply is actually just, again, seeing how the Buddha used that word. And not just in the treatises on the Dhamma, but also on the Vinaya. Because there was a type of meal which the nuns and the monks get called nicha butter. Nicha food. It's the opposite of anicca. And nicha food is food which will always come regularly to your monastery. Today is Friday. And I know, I wasn't at Bodhinyana Monastery this morning, but I know that Woody and so few of his friends would have gone to Bodhinyana Monastery this morning to offer the breakfast. They do that once a week. It's regular. It's nicha. It's nicha food. And some of you come, you know, one particular day of the week. You go to, say, Bodhinyana Monastery or Dhammasara, that's your regular supply of food. And when that doesn't occur, that's called anicca. Something which was always there and is now gone, disappeared, vanished. And in so much of our life, you know, we assume things because they're always there for us. We don't know what happens when they disappear. And one of those things, just as an example, is, you know, your will. What is your will? And one of the first times I started to really doubt, you know, who controls this thing I call my will, was just that a little experiment we did at university in our psychic research society. We got a hypnotist once a year to demonstrate hypnotism, you know, to the students. And there's always one person would be hypnotized really deeply. And fortunately it wasn't me. At least I don't remember it. Because they say afterwards, you'll forget whatever was said to you while you're under hypnosis. But anyway, this student who was hypnotized, who was told by the hypnotist that when the hypnotist touches his right ear lobe, then the student will, in a loud voice, or first of all, stand up in a loud voice, sing the British National Anthem, God Save the Queen. And so he took him out of hypnosis and said, you won't remember anything I said to you, but when I touch my right ear, you will sing the British National Anthem. And of course, you know, all the students who were in that lecture never actually told him what was up. We were always waiting to get this, to see this lecturer touch his right earlobe. And he was a good entertainer, the lecturer. He came very close to touching his right earlobe quite a few times. Got us excited. And then eventually he touched his right earlobe. And this student stood up in front of all the other students, singing the British National Anthem in the middle of a lecture. And just all the other students, including me, were howling with laughter, one of the funniest things I've seen, ridiculing him. It wasn't very fair, but when we were doing that, he just continued singing in a loud voice right to the very end. And when he finished singing the British National Anthem, then he sat down. And when we all stopped laughing at him, he wasn't at all embarrassed. We asked him, well, the lecturer asked him, why did you do that? Why did you stand up and sing the British National Anthem? And that's when he said, a good reason. He said, I just had this moment of patriotism. And I'm just so grateful that, you know, that we know we have this type of government in our country or whatever. He gave a logical reason. And even though we all know he was just hypnotized to say that, for him, or to sing that, for him it appeared to be his own free will. That's what it appeared to be. And that made me start doubting my free will. An example of that is, I wasn't so-called hypnotized, but I remember as a student once going to the shop, because in those days we didn't know that tobacco was bad for your health. And we saw all of these great professors, people like Albert Einstein, they'd always smoke pipes. That was almost like a symbol of being a learned academic. You had a pipe which you smoked. But in this advert, which I saw on the TV, there was a particular type of tobacco called, this was 1969 or something, a particular type of tobacco called St. Bruno tobacco, which was irresistible to the opposite gender. And in the advert, this ordinary-looking guy was walking down the street in some place in UK, and you know, people were ignoring him. And then he took out his pipe, he put the tobacco in, he lit it, and then the aroma just wafted, you know, into the newsagent shop. And in that newsagent shop, there was this incredibly beautiful girl, like a supermodel. And, you know, all those newsagent shops I'd ever been in, he never had anybody like that. But in the adverts, they did. And then she got totally enamored by the aroma of the tobacco. She jumped over the counter and just followed him down the street, waiting to do his every desire. And then they went past a greengrocer's shop. There's another beautiful blonde in there. She just left what she was supposed to be doing. There's someone working in the bank. She had to leave the bank and follow him because the aroma of St. Bruno tobacco was irresistible. And that was the advert. It's absolutely stupid, isn't it? You know, who would believe something like that? I'm supposed to be an intelligent guy. I poured some of that tobacco, tried it, and well, it sort of half worked. This dog followed me. I think it must have been a female, I'm not sure. No one else jumped over the counter. Have you ever done that? Something similar? Be honest. Because sometimes that's what the advertisements do. They condition you. And the way the adverts work is they're stupid, absolutely ridiculous. And you would think no intelligent person would ever believe that. And they repeat it, and they repeat it. It gets under your defenses. And after a while, you don't think you're being conditioned and brainwashed, but you are. And that's why they say, and I've checked this out with many people, that if you spend $1 in advertising, usually you get $3 back. It's a very, very efficient way of getting your returns on your profits. That's why Buddhist society, we don't advertise. Because if we did this whole... We did it once for meditation, Saturday afternoon meditation, and it was bedlam, mayhem. We got so many people come. So we don't like advertising. You get too many people. Just like at the bottom of the road with Southwest Highway and Kingsbury Drive, we used to have a sign there, sort of Bodhinyana Monastery, or even Retreat Centre. There's no sign there anymore. Otherwise, we get swamped. Do you think that's true? That's called negative advertising. But anyway, the conditioning which we have, you realize much of what you will is not your choice. It's been programmed into you. How you should behave as a, say, a young woman, filial piety, is that true? Or is that just what's been brainwashed into you by the culture in which you live? What you're supposed to, how you're supposed to act as a man or a woman, is that logical? Or has that been brainwashed into you? The clothes you wear, the way you you groom your hair, is that your choice? Or has it been brainwashed into you? I wear the same clothes every day, same hairstyle. A little by little, when you start to look at why you do things, your will, you actually start to doubt, is this coming from me? Where is it coming from? And little by little, as you start to get into meditation, you will notice you're not supposed to will anything at all. The goal is to calm down the will. Good old Ajahn Brahmadi, I saw this when I read the suttas in Pali, but no, he just emphasized it. And when we say, somebody mentioned the other day, sabba sankhara samatha, calming down all the sankharas. The meaning of that word sankhara in that context is will. Calming down all your will. Calming down so it's not there anymore. Sabba sankhara samatha. He said, few people will understand what that means, or they'll be scared of it. And the reason is because that will, that's one of your, I called it in a talk years ago, that's one of the last citadels, the last real refuges of your sense of self. I am the one who does. I am the one who knows. When you break down those two citadels, you see how empty they are. You see that you're none of these things. This is like just a simile which I gave years and years and years ago, called the simile of the driverless bus. And actually, I know when I gave this simile first of all, it would have been in 1991, so quite a long time ago, before Google ever thought of driverless buses. Or was it Google? Who does the driverless buses? It was mostly Google. And the simile of the driverless bus started from the idea that many people come to a meditation retreat, they learn meditation, or they do some spiritual practice like yoga, they come and listen to inspiring teachers, nuns and monks. Why? They do that in order that they can be wiser, kinder, and have less suffering in life. They feel they want to improve themselves, to grow in kindness and wisdom, and feel that that's the path out of suffering. But you find no matter how much you improve yourself, the self is fundamentally flawed, your idea of what it is. So there comes a time that people come, they want to be able to overcome their physical problems, their emotional problems, the existential problems, and still keep a happy home where you can retire in, happy ever after, for eternity. And that cannot be done. And that's challenging to accept that. But what happens? It's like a person's life, like a bus journey. And in your bus journey, sometimes, this is an old simile of life is just like a journey. In your journey, sometimes you go through such pleasant scenery. Wonderful landscapes, waterfalls, lakes, rivers, green pastures and fields and stuff. And you ask your bus driver, slow down. Look at this retreat, it's almost over, another day to go, and then it's finished. Where did that time go? It went so fast, for me anyway. Don't know about you. But anyway, that sometimes the good times in your life go too fast. So you want to tell the bus driver, your bus driver, your will. Please be smart. When you're enjoying life, please slow down so we can enjoy life longer. But when you're going through unpleasant experiences, wars, toxic nuclear waste dumps, bushfires and stuff, you want that, and cancers, you want that to go, you want to get through that quickly. So you ask your bus driver, can you please put your foot on the accelerator and speed out of here? And what does your bus driver usually do? When you're having a wonderful time, it accelerates out. When you're having a very difficult time, it tends to last longer than it should. In other words, you've got a very stupid bus driver. So you want to tell the bus driver how to drive the bus. But before you tell the bus driver how to drive the bus with more compassion and wisdom, you've got to find where the bus driver is, first of all. Who is in charge of all the decisions you make in your life? Where do those decisions come from? Why did you decide to come here for the last week? Who made that decision? And don't think that you did. That's how it appears. But when you find the bus driver's seats, you find that the bus driver's seat is empty. There's nothing there. Why? There's nothing. And that's shocking. It's not what you expected. But it's what's true. And it's incredibly beneficial. Because then what happens? What happens? You go back to your seat, you sit down, and you stop complaining. The bus is out of control. Beautiful territory, having a wonderful time. You don't say, stop, stop, there's no one to shout at. So at last you're peaceful and calm. It's like seeing the absence of the will as a fundamental aspect of this five khandhas. You know, that's what the Buddha always said about non-self. And part of that was saying, if there was a self, a person in control, you'd be able to do much better with your life. Control this and control that. But what happens when you realize there's no one in control, there's no bus driver? What happens is, you let go. You let it be. You stop fighting. You relax and become peaceful. You know, one of the stories of one of the Zen monks, and I kind of like this story. He was a good monk, living outside the village. They would feed him, and he would just meditate all day. And then one of the ladies in the village got pregnant with her boyfriend. And when the father found out, you know, who did this? Who was it? And she didn't want to Dobbin, as I say in Australia, blame her boyfriend. So thinking quickly, he said, oh, it was that monk. He did it. And so, what? We've been respecting that monk all this time. So they had a village meeting, and all the villagers went up to where that monk stayed and said, you're a bad monk. You know, you've made my daughter pregnant. No, you can't do that. It's really wrong. They really scolded him. And according to the story, as I heard it, the monk never protested. There was just too many of the villagers that had already made their mind up. So he just said, ah, so, okay. And then when the baby was born, they went up to see him again the second time and said, your baby, you look after it. And so they dumped this baby on the monk. And then that's very scary if you're a monk. There's a few times in some traditions when a baby is born and there's good disciples, they actually give the baby to the monk. That's happened to me many times. There's a baby and they give it to me. I hold it for a few seconds. I can't get rid of it quick enough, I must admit, in case it does something and I have to wash my robe afterwards. And then, because when you hold it, it's like you're blessing it. And then I give it back again. But this one, they gave it to the monk permanently. You know what the monk said? He didn't protest, he just said, ah, so. And then, of course, the mum started missing the kid. And so then she eventually confessed, you know, who the boyfriend was. It wasn't a monk. It was a young man from the village. And the young man had just gone off to the city and left her. And so she didn't really mind now, so saying who the real culprit was. And so all the people in the village had another meeting. And they went back up to see the monk and said, I'm terribly sorry, we accuse you of something you didn't do. And can we have the baby back? So the monk gave the baby back, and he didn't like sue them for defamation, or didn't sort of get angry at them. He just gave the baby back. They said they were sorry. He said, ah, so, okay. And the whole story, I thought, was fascinating, that there was, you know, maybe an enlightened being who would never blame anybody for what happened in life, would never say it's unfair, would never get angry at anybody, and would be able to look after even a baby. How on earth do you do that? Now, this is not an invitation for you to give me any babies. Please. Don't get the idea. I'm a monk. Now stop thinking. But nevertheless, the response there, accused of something you didn't do, put in a lot of difficulty, treated unfairly. What do you say? Also, okay. That degree of peace and stillness, that was something really amazing. And so after a while, you know, the idea of, well, why do you do things? Is it conditioning? What you're supposed to do, or is it something much deeper? I can't know why I started thinking of this story. It's conditioned in me. I didn't will. And so whatever I say, please don't blame me, because I'm just conditioned. It was one of my favorite stories from the Franciscan Buddhist tradition. Buddhist tradition, that's interesting. The Franciscan tradition. One of the things that they would go on alms round, and they'd never had any money until towards the end of St. Francis's life, his disciples had a big meeting. He was very popular by this time. And they said, well, you know, it's okay not to have money, you know, when St. Francis, you know, was young, but times change. We need to have money these days. And the father says, no, you don't. And he said, yes, we do. And so they outvoted their leader. And the Franciscans started to carry money again. And sometimes, you know, the monks and the nuns in our monasteries, we don't carry any money. We don't have any money. I've got no bank accounts. But they said, you know, that other monks say, oh, it's very good, but you know, times have changed. No, times haven't changed. Sometimes greed conditions your will. You find arguments and excuses to do what you want to indulge in. So little by little, we understand where the will comes from. It's also one of the reasons you can't blame yourself. One of the reasons why every time anybody does something, I was going to say wrong, but that's not the right word. Anyone doesn't keep the precepts, or they do something which they're not supposed to do, so they think. So, like that, like that Anagarika, who went into the kitchen and made himself at night time and made himself a sandwich. No, that's not against the rules, making the sandwich. Eating it was. And that's what he did. And when he ate it, he enjoyed it, got rid of his hunger for a little while, but afterwards he was so remorseful. He came to see me early in the morning and said that, you know, I'd done a terrible thing. He was actually crying in front of me, a man, Anagarika. I did a terrible thing, I just really want to be a monk, but I had a sandwich last night. And of course, you know, what would be a wise person's reaction? You know, just be kind, you can forgive. And also to give him some more information about eating more at lunchtime, so he doesn't feel so hungry during night time. And all the other things which nuns and monks can eat in the evening. There's heaps of things you can eat and drink. Sometimes you don't even need breakfast and lunch, do we? Anyway, so having said all of that, he was the guy who said he demanded a punishment. And I'm thankful he asked me for the punishment, because it just emphasized just how we've been conditioned. If we do something wrong, we want some sort of penance or punishment. And I say, we don't do punishments in Buddhism. You understand, you learn, and you grow. So you don't need to do it again. You don't need to be punished. But he insisted, I need a punishment. So that's when I sentenced him to the 50 strokes of the cat. You know what that means? Because I just read the book that morning, I think, John Hughes' Fatal Shore, where the original people who came to Australia were mostly convicts. And they were whipped with this, you know, brutal cat of nine tails. Said, I'll give you 50 strokes of the cat. And I still remember his face. His face went whiter than the Anagarika clothes he was wearing. His jaw dropped. Yeah, he really thought I was going to whip him. Can't do anything like that. But then when I told him what 50 strokes of the cat is, it's like, fine, we had two cats there. Kit Kat was one of them. Find one of the cats and stroke it 50 times. One. To learn some compassion, some kindness, because that's what he was missing in life. So he was conditioned, his will expected a punishment, but in the monastery we don't do that, we just give kindness. So anyway, this other Francis story, which I truly like, there one of the monks there was very simple, was out on his arms round one morning. And as he was out on his arms round, as one of the beggars in the street saw him and said, you know, you're asking me for things? I'm really poor. Haven't you got any proper clothes to wear? You've got your robe. And this monk thought, that's a good point. The monk was compassionate and kind. You know, other people were generous to him. Why can't he be generous to them? So he took off his robe and gave it to the poor man. It's really nice. But then when he got back to the monastery, the other monk saw this naked person coming in and said, look, we don't have any weird people coming in here, no deviants, no, you can't come in here, this is for monks, not for you. They didn't recognize him. When he started speaking, he said, no, I just gave my robe away. And they thought he'd been robbed or something, but anyway, when they found out it was him, they gave him another robe from the store, and everything was okay until the next day. All the robbers in that village or town, they soon got to know that this monk was a bit of an easy touch, a bit soft in the, I better not say. So they, another beggar asked him for his robe, he gave that one as well. He gave about three or four of his robes, he came back. This time they recognized who he was. Come in. But then the nice part of this story was when the abbot, the head monk, said, no, we can't keep losing all our robes like this. Just the people in the town are just taking advantage of him. So he called him into his office. And the abbot, the head monk, just really scolded, you know, the young monk. Scolded him and told him that these robes are not to be given away, they're for you, we haven't got that many of them, if you keep giving them away we'd have none left. And the monk never tried to defend himself. He just put his head down and listened to the scolding. And when the abbot thought he'd scolded him enough, then the monk just left. He came back half an hour later with a cup of soup. And the abbot said, what's the soup for? And the monk said, you've been shouting at me for so long. Your throat must be so sore. Have some soup. And he wasn't trying to be clever. This monk was just such a pure-hearted person. And he never thought that he didn't deserve the scolding. He just felt compassion for the person who gave him the scolding. He needed some soup. As a result of that, the abbot told the monk, you can give away as many robes as you like. How can you stop someone who's so compassionate and kind like that? The compassion and kindness was the most important. But anyway, back to the will. So when you understand what the will is, we tend actually to learn not to complain so much and blame other people. People are growing. We try to protect ourselves and protect others. But don't be so critical of others. And when we're not so critical of others, you know, the defilement of anger starts to disappear. The defilement of desire starts to disappear. When we realize all our will is actually conditioned into us, brainwashed into us. That's also why we follow a very important teaching of the Buddha, which is always to associate with good people, with kind people. And sometimes people don't realize the power of that. It's the story behind that, which you know is in one of the Dhammapada stories, that there was the royal elephant. In those days, the elephant was just a means of transport, especially for wealthy people and royalty. And so the king had this amazing elephant who was just so such a good ride, and he would go even through the jungle on top of this elephant. And the elephant would always really be well behaved. Just like even these days in Sri Lanka, you got the elephants who carry the Buddha's tooth relic, you know, just on the celebratory days. So anyway, this was a wonderful elephant, but then the elephant started to get badly behaved. You know, would wait to poo when the trainer was right behind him, would squirt water even on the king. And he was always a well-behaved elephant, and so the king was really, is the elephant sick? Has he got COVID? Or, I just put that in there. why is the elephant just so badly behaved? And the doctors try to find out a reason, no reason, can't see any sickness anywhere. And so just one of the ministers in the government tried to find out what was happening. When the minister tried to find out what was happening, he said, I'm going to stay up with the elephant all night and see what happens at night time when no one's looking. And he found out that just behind the elephant stall was a place where a gang of really robbers, drug dealers, were meeting every evening. And they were meeting there because it was quiet, secluded. And even though the elephant didn't understand anything which the robbers were saying, as they used to say, they got the vibes of those bad people and picked up on that bad vibe, the bad talk. Even though I never understood it, understood at least it was very violent and aggressive. And because the elephant had been conditioned by that night after night for weeks, that was the cause of the elephant becoming a bad elephant. And so what the minister did, he got those thieves and bandits arrested, and he asked the monks and nuns to go behind the elephant stall in the evening to meditate, to chant. And when they did that, after a few weeks, the elephant became a good elephant again. And that was a story about associating with wise people, with kind people. Even if you can't understand what they're actually saying, you still pick up on the energy. It's one of the reasons why that people send say their husbands to stay at the monastery, their wives to stay at Dhammasala, to hang out with the monks or hang out with the nuns for a couple of weeks. And of course you pick up all the good vibes from the nuns and the monks. And you go home like sending your car to be tuned up and conditioned, like a new model. Because you associate with good people. The problem is, what happens to the monks? Because they're associated with you. No, they've got enough reserves there to be able to cope. But I like that story because sometimes it's even with your kids. There's one gentleman years ago, and his father, he was in Singapore, and his son got involved in really the heavy drugs. And that's really, really dangerous. You can go to prison and even get executed in Singapore for that. So he was smart enough, his father sent his son to Bodhinyana Monastery. And he hung out there for about a month, I think. And afterwards he made lots of good friends, good associates there. And that's where he gave up his habit. And then later on he did well in life, got married, had a couple of kids. And he's a good supporter of Bodhinyana Monastery. Simply because, you know, associating with good people for a while. And he's always grateful for that. So these are little stories about just your will when you understand what it is. So if you want to meditate, if you say you want to get a nimitta, how do you do that? Don't try and exert your will. See if you can associate with good people, with kind people, with still people. And after a while you pick up their teachings. You get conditioned, brainwashed if you like. And of course I've been brainwashing you for years. It's a slow process, but it does work. It worked with me, with Ajahn Chah, brainwashing me all the time. That's one of the reasons why you like to associate, you know, very wise, kind people. And little by little, it means you have the courage to let go. You start to stop controlling, letting things be. All those times I said when you're overcoming the sloth and torpor, everything I'd learned before from meditation or from life was always anything worthwhile you had to strive for and work hard for. It didn't make any sense that some of the best things in life, like, you know, nimittas and jhanas and deep wisdom, that that would actually come through letting go. I too thought, no, just you let go, your mind will wander all over the place. You know, you won't get anywhere, you get worse than when you started. But then, with someone like an Ajahn Chah conditioning you, brainwashing you all the time, after a while you just tried not to try. You had the courage to let go. You had the strength to improve your kindness rather than your willpower. And then, you know, you experience things like the driverless bus, you realize this will is not your friend, it doesn't even belong to you. It's actually enemy number one, if you really want to say that to meditation. Your will is what stops you being peaceful. It's like a person who's always on your back, always telling you, sit up straight, don't lean over, don't think stupid thoughts, be more mindful, do this, do that, do something else. But anything, just do something to disturb yourself. Instead of just leaving it alone, letting it be, letting it grow. So the opposite of will is loving kindness, otherwise known as letting things be. The door of my heart is open no matter what's happening. Not judgmental, allowing it to be. Then you get really still. You don't just get still, it's like you're turning off this process called your body and mind. You start disappearing. That's what the jhanas are, deep bliss, because things start to vanish. And if you do that properly, it means that when deep understandings do happen, the understanding of the stream winner is there's no self. The whole five khandhas, the body, the Vedana experience, will, sankharas, perceptions, and consciousnesses, six totally different kinds, are not who you are. They're not yourself. As a scientist, I always look at particle physics. What are the fundamental particles of nature? And it used to be like the atom. People always thought the atom was the fundamental particle until Rutherford split the atom. You know what the atom means? It's indivisible. It's a Greek word. And it's a word very similar to atom. It's called atma in Pali, atta, the sense of self. That sense of self, the soul, the ego, the me, the essence, the permanent essence, that too was meant to be indivisible, permanent, who you are, who you think you are. And then, just as Rutherford split the atom, the Buddha split the Atma a long time ago in order to realize there is nothing stable, permanent there. It's a process. And even your will, which you think you control, you don't. You are conditioned. Why, at the end of the chanting or the talk, do you say, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu? Where did that come from? Conditioned into you. But it's a positive conditioning, because it makes it happy, energized, and it's good for the health and good for the meditation as well. Where did you get the ideas of, like, make peace, be kind, be gentle? Of just being able to not actually do anything when you meditate, just be there and just watch, and be kind, and not interfere. Where did I get the idea from of just when you're watching a nimitta, just be like the observer by the still forest pool, animals coming out. You don't disturb them. All those similes get conditioned into you. And that allows you to actually, to eventually see those nimittas and get those jhanas. Trying to convince people you don't need to be afraid of the jhanas. When you get convinced not to be afraid, then they happen. And to say you don't do them. So don't own them and feel proud. You've got jhanas. Who's got jhanas this retreat? None of you. Because you have to disappear first of all before those jhanas happen. In other words, they're not personal attainments. They're the opposite. It's personal disappearances, vanishing, losing things. And again, that's one of the reasons why. You know, you say these things, sometimes people think they're jokes. That's one of the reasons why in one of those books which I wrote, I think it's The Art of Disappearing, the preface there, a foreword, whatever you call it. Now everyone has to do a foreword before you publish that book. So Wisdom Publications asked me to do a foreword for that book. And I just wrote one down in just a couple of minutes, maybe 5 minutes, just a joke. You know, jokes are very easy to write, except that sometimes you're laughing when you write it, so you have to pause and wipe your eyes. And in the end, if you read that, the end word was, "And so, I hope you all get lost." And I sent it off to the publishers over in the US, and I said, "I know this is going to be rejected. I'll send a proper one this afternoon, a proper forward." And the email came back almost immediately, "No, we love this." They knew enough about what I was saying to realize it wasn't just being offensive. It was being, what's the word, incisive. The idea of reading that book of meditating was for you to get lost, to lose your sense of attaining things, owning things, of your will being how you get enlightened. You abandon your will. You allow it to become soft and peaceful. It's like kindness, real compassion. It's not will. There's no will and wanting and trying to get something there at all. You're giving, expecting nothing back in return. It's why even this jhana grove, there's very few places like this in the world where you don't see the names of the people who donated to build this. Usually there's a whole list of donors. And even actually give it like the name of the hall. You know, like Paul Dhamma Hall. Paul Hall. Oh, well, I don't know. We don't do that here because that is not real donations. That's not dana. That's buying advertising rights for your name. And there's something really wrong with that. So many people donated so much for this, but we don't know who they were. I know, they know, and that's all that's necessary. And that's beautiful when you get nothing back in return. But nevertheless, you have to mention that on this hall here, I usually mention this every time I do a retreat, on that side of the bamboo floor, that when we were building Jhana Grove, I think it was 2009, I think. Is that about right? Yeah, good. 2009, the Easter retreat was supposed to be the first retreat for Jhana Grove. And we were going to open it with a big ceremony on Good Friday and then start on Saturday. A shortened retreat, but still. You know, Good Friday, public holiday, nice time for a opening ceremony. And that evening, Thursday evening, the builder had told me 6 months earlier, "No worries, the building will be finished on time." Have you ever built anything like a house? Or is it always built on the time when the builder will say it? So anyway, the day before, we were working really hard, trying to finish it off. And even though there's so much work to be done, especially this hadn't been covered with the bamboo flooring yet, I looked for the builder, and the builder had left for the weekend. Actually, no, there's still a few builders there. They're having a barbecue just by the dam. There's work to be done. Oh, no, we're not working now. Long weekend holiday. So anyway, we couldn't get anyone to finish the floor here. We're having our opening ceremony, and also a lot of VIPs, like Jeff Gallup, he came for that one, for the opening ceremony, and there was no floor. So what do we do? It's just generosity and kindness, goodness. So all the monks, I didn't stay up. Santuti, Bamali, they're all up here finishing that floor at night time. It's about 4 o'clock in the morning. So that was actually done the last minute. It's beautiful, it's perfect. Stayed up all night, had an hour's rest, and then came up for the ceremony in the morning. That's how we do these things. Total last minute, great fun, lots of merit. That's a beautiful part of the kindness when we don't try and control anything. It's always a mess, but those messes are wonderful. That's why the ceremonies which I remember from Thailand, just they were totally disorganized. But that gave them the humanity, the naturalness, and it worked. Any of you go to any of the ordination ceremonies? We always crack a few jokes. At least I do anyway. Like when we have a novice ordination. You know what novice means? No vice. Oh, come on. And even though some people think things go wrong because they have such a strong will, they just want to organize it and get it done this way and not that way. The way I was brought up, it works out somehow or other. And so when you have those disorganized ceremonies, then you find it just so much more fun, so much more deep, and allows other people to come in and help. Those are beautiful. So I often say, if ever any of you just really do not like organized religion, you've come to the right place. This is disorganized. A disorganized retreat. Okay, I better finish off now. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Thank you. Okay. I hope there was something useful there for you. Okay, we have a few interviews, and then, as usual, please meditate if you wish, or whatever you want to do.